Previously.tv Podcast Network.
She was the, you know, and this is coming from an acting point of view, someone who believes that in order to act, you tell the truth. You know, you look in the camera and you tell the truth. You believe, you commit, you are that person. You are 100% there, committed. When she was there, it was the poorest acting job, one of the poorest acting jobs I think I'd ever seen.
Netflix's not-so-hot take on Boulder's most infamous cold case, and a look back at the grandpappy of the TV true crime genre. It's Casting JonBenet and Unsolved Mysteries on The Blotter Presents, Episode 8. Hello, everybody. I'm your beleaguered lieutenant, Sarah D. Bunting. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. I am here with hotshot out-of-town profiler, Kevin Smokler. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Kevin is the author of Brat Pack America, a love letter to 80s teen movies. I feel like, based on what we'll be talking about today, there will not be a follow-up called A Love Letter to Lifetime-esque Netflix Movies. But I could be wrong.
No, you're exactly right.
Okay. Before we get into our most quote unquote wanted this week, a little pod business. Our drop date is moving to Wednesdays. So if you're listening to this, you probably already know that because it's Wednesday. But in case you're a little late downloading it because you thought it was Fridays, we're moving it up a bit. Okay. I hesitate to get back into this JonBenet business, but here we go. Casting JonBenet in our most wanted segment. Okay. So here's the thing about this.
Big sigh, big cleansing breath.
Yes. I had watched almost all of the anniversary of the murder programming last year.
Right.
I had not actually planned to watch this, but there was a bit of a lull in new stuff, TV true crime wise. And I thought, well, this sounds so superfluous, inappropriate, and contrived that maybe it'll be awesome. Well, it was all of those things, and it did a couple things well, but awesome it was not. Kevin, my sense is that you thought even less of it than I did.
Yeah, I am intrigued by this premise, which seems to be I wouldn't call it a bumper crop, but certainly a high harvest yield of incidences, documentaries about tragic incidences being explored via people being cast in fictional roles about them. There's got to be a shorter, more eloquent way to say that. But I feel like this comes hot on the heels of the documentary Kate Plays Christine, which is about the actress playing Christine Chubchek, I think is how her name is pronounced. She was a Sarasota, Florida news anchor who famously committed suicide in the middle of a broadcast. And there was an excellent documentary made, I believe, in 2014 about the actress playing her in a production of it. And it was a fantastic exploration of what does it mean to inhabit a real person whose life ended so tragically.
Right.
Yeah, flash forward, we have Casting JonBenet, which the circumstances of which this casting is happening is never quite explained. But we meet a series of Boulder citizens, some of them trained actors, most of them not, all auditioning to appear as the principal roles in the tragic story of the death of JonBenet Ramsey, a 6-year-old found dead in her family's basement right after Christmas in 1996. A case that you'll pardon the old chestnut here shocked the nation, And contextually, we don't know what these people are auditioning for. We don't know what the filmmaker, an Australian, whose last name is Green, Tiffany Green, I believe is her name.
Kitty Green.
Thank you. I get them mixed up because another person last name Green did Kate Plays Christine, Robert Green. So Kitty Green, an Australian filmmaker, puts this together. We don't know what she has asked these people to do. We don't know what the end result of this casting will be, if only to as a premise to make a documentary about the impressions of the community. The impressions that stay with them 21 years later now.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a big process person, so I think it would have been much more interesting to see a little bit of the prompts that the production was giving to these actors during their talking head interviews to get these responses, because often you were in kind of this like condescending waiting for Guffman zone.
Right.
These people about their craft and about their crackpot theories, and that one private investigator who was doing a demonstration of his cat of nine tails and talking about breast bondage.
Yeah.
Which do you, but this is not pertinent.
No, the fact that he calls himself a sex educator, that was one of those, like, you expect an experienced documentary filmmaker, no matter how juicy that sounds on the surface, to exercise discretion and not go down that blind alley. And she walks forward and backward and somersaults down that blind alley.
And so
we have to get this person who's in this guy who's auditioning for, I believe, the police captain of Boulder, who's a minor role in this crime, to be sure. We get three or four scenes of him demonstrating his day job, which involves literally whips and chains, and seems to be, I think, condescending waiting for Guffman is an apt description, because the movie seems to be almost saying, oh, just let the camera run long enough. These people will make asses of themselves eventually.
Right. Which is, I mean, that's not untrue.
Yeah.
But again, what are we trying to do here? Because, you know, you mentioned that we aren't really told, like, what is this project going to look like when it's done? Or is it only for this sort of collage of all the different people that we've seen auditioning for the different roles in different spaces in the set, testing out different theories of what happened, that I found actually rather affecting.
Yeah.
But I got the feeling that the actors weren't in on the joke, which was on them, and if they were, then why not just tell us what you're doing? I thought the vagueness was a little much, especially since that ending, I thought, was kind of good and kind of interesting, like all of them kind of patched into the space at the same time. I thought that was kind of a neat take on it, kind of collage-y, but then because we don't have enough information about the plan, and except to think that, well, let's just listen to clip number two and then
sure.
And then talk about it. Okay, folks, what you've just listened to is a series of auditioners for the role of Burke Ramsey, John Pei's older brother.
Oh, man.
Covered in plastic tarp, wearing plastic goggles, and using mag lights to smash one of those little baby watermelons that's about the size of a child's head.
Yes.
In the middle there, the kid has hit the thing so hard that it like rebounds onto his thumb. In the last part, the kid has rolled the watermelon off the counter entirely, and then he goes, there it goes, and then he eats a piece of what is, you know, in character, his sister's brain.
Yeah.
Now, I am not a prude. I'm not easy to shock. And after the case of JonBenet, where they put pig skin over an actual skull, put a blonde wig on it, and had some kid wailing on it with a mag light. This is horribly vulgar,
yeah.
But it doesn't faze me exactly. But it's like, why are we seeing a reenactment of a Gallagher show in the middle of this? That's
I just can't. It feels like it feels like footage they found on the editing room floor that they just couldn't let go of. You know, the feeling I get from this whole documentary, and maybe this is even giving Kriti Green and team too much credit, is there's a whole better imaginary documentary out there about an actual production of some kind, a docudrama about the death of JonBenet Ramsey. And this is the auditioner's footage from it. And they've simply chosen horribly wrongly what to focus on. I was first reminded of that documentary about The Shining, Room 237, which uses this technique where a bunch of ardent Shining fans of the Stanley Kubrick movie, give their theories on what The Shining is actually about. And the technique the filmmaker chooses is you never see them. You only hear their voices kind of offering up their theories over scenes from The Shining. And it's an affecting technique, to be sure. And maybe someone smarter than me knows why they chose it. But I remember finishing the movie, enjoying it, and yet still feeling at a loss as to, like, why did they do it that way, other than, you know, some sort of documentary parlor trick? Does that trick exist for any other reason other than someone was on the set one day and thought it would be cool? And I'm left with that kind of empty rationale with this. The idea of exploring a crime through people playing the role does, at a distance, poke at something very interesting, which is the idea that to investigate a moment that none of us were there for and none of us will ever truly know the truth of, it does involve kind of putting on a hat and being someone else. That is the process of both imagination and investigation, no matter how horrible the thing you're investigating is or imagining. And yet it feels like sort of trickery in service of nothing. And in this case, with the kids smashing the watermelon, you're right. Like, I'm not a prude either, but that's just, at best, it's incredibly tacky. And at worst, it's downright exploitative. It's like making these kids look like little monsters without, with them clearly not conscious, clearly not all aware of what they're participating in. Gross was the word I walked away with for those series of moments.
Yeah, I completely agree. I watch a lot of documentaries and I'm sort of inured to tricksiness of this type. That's fine. And I think that in some cases, like I think in Room 237, which it's been a while since I've seen it, but I got the sense that it was one of those things where, like, whatever they were doing on camera was looking a little cheesy. So they decided to, like, take a bunch of things off screen and just suggest them, which, like, I don't know. I certainly, you know, as someone who has, like, spent a long time in the do-it-yourself space, sometimes you just have to fudge things and hope nobody notices or is looking at something else. But in this case, it did really feel like, I mean, there's one segment, and we'll have a little picture of this in our header graphic for the podcast, but one of these girls is being endlessly made up and having this wig carefully pinned into her own hair and is just staring into space eating a cookie. And I thought that was a good moment because it's like, okay, she's playing JonBenet, but she's also just a kid who's like, this is boring and she's having a snack. Just like JonBenet was, that you sometimes forget in the, you know, hubbub of her horrible death and the horrible job Boulder PD did investigating it and securing the crime scene and all of that stuff. This was just a little girl who was like a normal little girl. This was like a pretty normal family, despite everyone's like arcane, creepy theories about her father touching her. So I think that this filmmaker, Kitty Green, was on to something, but she should have kept this, she should have made it shorter. And she definitely should have cut out the watermelon part, or maybe the real documentary that she was meant to make, in my opinion, was about the life of a professional Santa. Let's listen to a clip.
Oh, yeah.
This is why I have a background check every year, and the professional Santas that I mingle with have background checks. They have the insurance. We're trained. We're trustworthy.
Just as an aside, which I don't tell most people, we wear white gloves. And the main reason we wear white gloves is because in a photo, it's much easier to identify where your hands are.
How is the guy going to sneak into the house, especially if he's going to come around looking like Santa Claus? You know, I mean, you don't go around in a red suit in public and not be noticed. You know, I mean, that's a bunch of crap.
Well, you might on Christmas Eve, but
well, that's the thing. Like the one day that he could get away with it, but. I found those insights. I mean, that's not why you wear white gloves, guy. Yeah. You wear it because that's the costume.
Yeah.
But I was like, all right, this is interesting to me. Like, how have certain scandalous cases involving children changed the lives, the professional lives of people who work with children, not just like teachers or caregivers, but like Santa?
Absolutely.
That was interesting.
It was really interesting. Like I'm not going to press too hard on this theory, but more evidence that there's a good movie somewhere buried in the you know, the scattered pieces of this one. I would watch the shit out of the sort of OSHA rules and occupational hazards of being a Santa documentary. I was immediately picturing like. And then you interview a group of Easter bunnies who are like, we're like, well, we don't have this problem. We got big paws and everybody knows where the big paws are. So nobody worries about the Easter bunny, you know, getting fresh with kids. There's a really good movie to be done there. And, you know, not for nothing. That was the original premise of Capturing the Freedmans. The original premise of Capturing the Freedmans was about it was about professional clowns. David Freeman, one of the Freedman kids, was a renowned professional clown in New York City, and that's where the idea for that movie originated. And then the Jarecki brothers found out that he was the Freedman of that famous Freedman case. Tell me something. I think I may be not stretching the timeline back far enough, but I feel like the John Ridley TV show American Crime has created this really interesting idea that crime is sort of the taking off point for the study of how a crime affects a community. And I feel like, I'm sure it's earlier than that, but I feel like the most recent and visible incarnation in pop culture of it is American Crime. And I feel like this movie, again, points at that idea with a long stick. But there are these few throwaway lines where it's like, well, we never pictured something like this happening in Boulder and then there's another throwaway line where someone's like, well, a lot of weird stuff happens in Boulder. And I'm like, Boulder is the Cambridge of Colorado. Like Boulder is a big, is the big university town in Colorado that is mostly filled with REIs and expensive coffee. I don't feel like the movie takes advantage of the community and the community's feelings or expectations towards violence at all.
Like, having spent all of, 72 hours in Boulder and it was for a funeral, like, yes, weird shit happens in Boulder, but it's involving like, this Vespa is powered by celery. Like, like harmlessly, hippily weird.
Yeah.
And not like Pacific Northwest Twilight of Bundy weird.
Like, yeah.
This, although, I mean, Colorado's a big state. A lot of different shit goes on there. I'm not willing to, again, having spent in the, you know, state lifetime, maybe 5 days, I'm not really willing to sort of make generalizations about their relationship to crime versus that of Florida or Jersey or whatever. But, and I think you're onto something with the American crime thing, too. And there might have been a more interesting, I think she stopped short of trying to unpack the dicey relationship that anyone telling a story about a crime, whether it's a documentary or you're writing a book or you're writing a scripted drama based on a real crime, or even in my case, reviewing these pieces of work, that it's like, we're not quote unquote reviewing the crime. We're reviewing the work about the crime, but you're consistently in this like slightly dicey position of like feeling like there's a good story, but not wanting to be disrespectful to the very real pain and horror of families and communities that radiated out from these crimes. So all this by way of saying, I think that that's a really interesting point, and I think that's worth doing. And I think maybe Kitty Green started to do that, but it was easier to just do this thing that was a little more cutesy and empty.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like a gesture in search of a movie. I don't know. Tell me how you felt around many of the performers, probably 80% of the auditioners, you know, offering up their theory of what actually happened to JonBenet. I don't know how you could avoid that question. It also didn't sit well with me because, like, would that even be a question you would ask in an audition? I mean, I suppose you would ask why you want to audition for this part, but I don't know if that prompts a theorizing on the solution to an unsolved crime at the center of whatever this dramatic effort is. It feels a little bit like, to me, it felt a little bit like, you know, the reason that Brian Reed gave for dropping all 7 episodes of S-Town at once was because they didn't want people endlessly theorizing on what S-Town was about the way they did for Serial. And I understand that's a human instinct, but I wonder if that's a human instinct, even if it's not really part of the project.
Yeah, that was the dullest part. For me. I mean,
me too.
You know, I'm not uninterested in the case, but I was much more interested in, as I said before, the questions that led to responses about acting or prompts that probably were perfectly average prompts, like, okay, you know, click the little slate and tell us about yourself. And this guy who's like, I'm a husband and a dad and a convicted felon. And I decided when I was in jail for hanging bad paper that I wanted to get into acting. And I was like, okay, like that's, I mean, a con is a con is a con,
yeah,
actually. But there were little bits of these people's backgrounds and their relationship to losing a child to, and like the way that they were going to plug into this as actors, that was sort of interesting, and I did wonder a little bit about how they elicited those responses, but this, like, well, you know, obviously it was John Mark Carr until it wasn't, like, you know, this is what we have Reddit for, and I don't really find this all that interesting. So, yeah, I almost recommend watching it if you're an actor.
Yeah, like, that's
I'm going to have my husband watch it and see what he thinks, because I'm interested to see, if he agrees with us that it's quite condescending to non-coastal actors, and B, if he agrees with the our opening clip that it's about getting to the truth, which was like a little on the nose, but she was so sincere in the way that she said it. But generally, I can't, as part of like the JonBenet factual library, I can't really recommend this one. You?
No, I can't either. I haven't spent as much time in that library as you have. I was kind of interested in what you thought contextually as to how, if one was to spend some time with Netflix's original documentaries, of which I'd say probably 30 to 40% are true crime, what is a smarter way to go than this?
Well, I'm trying to think of the other ones that I know are Netflix originals.
The Amanda Knox documentary is a Netflix original.
Right. That was pretty good. That was like a BP+. I didn't know much about that case. I thought the way they marketed it was interesting, if extremely cynical. I don't know. I mean, I think that maybe Netflix is better at the series, or the less conventional, like not features, like not a conventional feature length documentary, but I could be wrong about that. And I haven't dug as far into some of their true crime as I could have. So, but this one, I don't know. And especially if you have case fatigue, it's probably not for you.
No, as it stands right now, I kind of feel the same. I feel like I didn't spend much time with Making a Murder, or Making a, was that what it was called?
Yeah.
But it seemed to me like that was Netflix doing true crime, you know, harnessing the full powers of what Netflix is, versus an Amanda Knox documentary.
And speaking of harnessing the full powers of what Robert Stack is, it's time for Cold Case. So I'm going to let you take the lead on this, because I don't know exactly what we're talking about specifically, but in order to prep for this segment, I did continue my march to the sea of the end of the Stack episodes looking for my husband's segment. No luck yet, but I was reunited with the creepiest theme song, the wonderful, chilling minor chord anticipation that is the Unsolved Mysteries opener. Let's have a listen right now and get in the mood.
Join me. You may be able to help solve the mystery.
It still works.
I'm hiding under the bed, surrounded by stuffed animals as we speak.
Little hairs. I watched the one that was about the General Wayne Inn, I think. It's like season one, episode 7, and all the strange, like, ghosty shit that goes on at this rundown motel in along the Philadelphia main line.
Oh, yes.
And that, like, head in a jar thing that does the slow fade out. I was like, that is so cheesy.
Oh, yeah.
And then I had to, like, sleep with the light out. Like, I had to run downstairs, like, get in my husband's lap. He's like, have you been watching Unsolved Mysteries again?
Oh, yeah.
No. So you've been working your way through the whole Stacklopedia.
Yeah.
What inspired you to do that?
So when you come out with a book, that has a love letter to 80s teen movies as the subtitle, which my book Brat Pack America does, if people are intrigued by the topic, they're probably intrigued by the decade, and you start getting sent sort of random dispatches from pop culture from 30 years ago. So I've been sent a bunch of stuff about retro video games, a bunch of stuff about a bunch of stuff about Miami Vice fashion and fruit roll-ups and, you know, Cabbage Patch Kids, you name it. And of course, when it was announced that the first four seasons, i.e. really, really the golden era of Unsolved Mysteries, which was on the air for a crazy long time, I believe 1987 to 1987 to 2002. But really the golden era is the initial decade, 87 to 97, hosted by the late, great Robert Stack. And the first four seasons are now available on Amazon Video, free if you have Prime. And this is really the first time that Unsolved Mysteries with any sort of completeness has been available to the fan. Prior to this, I really think it suffered kind of the way that Sex and the City suffered, which is it was really the victim of bad syndication choices. For a whole generation of Sex and the City fans, they only knew the sort of chopped up, edited, bolderized version that was first on TBS and then on the E Network. And never mind, that was an HBO show that had, you know, plenty of cursing and plenty of nudity and was all the funnier and richer for it. Unsolved Mysteries was one of those shows that was only first available in sort of thematic DVD box sets. You know, you could get a box.
Sort of like the Time Life packaging of it, like the ghosts ones, like the UFOs ones, which I was like, well, I won't be needing those.
No, exactly.
I always skip those things.
Yeah, exactly.
So boring.
Sort of in real contrast to what was great about the show in the first place was that it had four segments and you can kind of pick and choose which sort of segment were your bag. And then it was sort of repackaged and tarted up for Spike TV, hosted, I will say, admirably by Dennis Farina, but the cutting was sped up by about three times. I mean, you feel like you've had half a dose of meth watching it now. I think it's still running on Spike TV in that format. And
I think that's right. Occasionally a royalty check does come to the house.
Yeah.
Or not a royalty check, you know what I'm talking about. A residual. Thank you.
Yeah, with this kind of pounding, 5-hour energy drink score to it. And
the Google Earth. Like we know where Terre Haute is, for Christ's sake.
Exactly. It's not, no slag to Dennis Farina, who does what he can in this really, really stupid packaging choice for this series. But the Unsolved Mysteries of yore is the one that everybody should be spending their time with. And you can now get the first four seasons, the first, 96 episodes, via Amazon. And I have been accompanying you on a similar march to the sea. And the first thing you realize, and this is a very shallow comment, but the first thing you realize is Unsolved Mysteries is the perfect show for how we watch television now. You can rewind and fast forward as you see fit. If the ghost segment or the paranormal segment ain't your thing and you just want murders and missing people, you only have to watch that. You can fast forward past the theme song, which I've done plenty of because I'd like to get a decent night's sleep. And they all end on this wonderful coda of Robert Stack intoning that, for every mystery, there's someone somewhere who knows the answer. Perhaps it's you.
Oh, yes. Let's listen to that now.
For every mystery, there is someone somewhere who knows the truth. Perhaps that someone is watching. Perhaps it's you.
And then the mournful coda of perhaps
I still
you.
Think it's
Why
me.
Why haven't you called?
Like, 30.
I love that this was basically a subreddit before that ever existed. Before Al Gore invented the internet, it existed in the form of Unsolved Mysteries and their little telephone operator bay manned occasionally by, what was her
Keely
name?
Keely Shea Smith, Pierce Brosnan's wife. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, which I'm convinced was a spare office at Warner Brothers or something that they just put a bunch of people in, but that it is impossible to deny that that was part of the reason people tuned in every week, was to see if A, these crimes had been solved, or, and just as much B, to see if they could somehow participate in solving them. I think everybody who watched that show originally, or even now, probably had a moment where they were waiting for a bus or in line for a sandwich, and they're like, "Is that the missing housewife from Terre Haute that I thought was on Unsolved Mysteries the other night?"
Is that Annie Laurie Barron, happily living her best life far away from
Jackson, Mississippi,
the site of the kidnapping? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's so funny too, because we were talking about this before we recorded, but it really speaks to that wonderful, that what we find compelling about Unsolved Mysteries is that they're unsolved, mm-hmm. and that there is that delightful tension of like, maybe this is the book that will let me solve it, but that also there is something appealing about a mystery that can't be solved, possibly because whatever theory you come up with can't really be disproven.
Yeah.
But then Unsolved Mysteries had it both ways, because occasionally they'd be like, update, and then that little like Casio trill that let you know that
the update theme.
Every now and then, you do get some satisfaction, and they had to wait like a decade for DNA and the internet to sort of get up to what they were already doing and knock some of these out. But like unsolved.org has been up and running the whole time and is still there.
Yeah.
And has a whole library of stuff to read about.
So, and I believe still managed by John Cosgrove and Terry Dunmer, the producers and creators of the show. Who knew that – I'm sure they didn't – that when they started this show that they would essentially be tending the fires of it, 30 years later. It really does. I mean, this has been said so often now that it almost doesn't bear repeating. It really does both get to that idea that one of the things we find so seductive about true crime is it allows us to speculate on something we cannot truly know, that by definition we weren't there and we can never really know what happened. And
to control something that's essentially random.
Yeah.
Certainly in the case of serial killers, I think.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah. And then it sort of deals from the top and bottom of the deck, in that not only did they have a mechanism by which these crimes could be investigated and some of them ultimately solved, but if you watch it on Amazon now, many more of them have been solved, and it tells you as much. On the premise that that most crimes are not committed by dastardly criminal masterminds, and are committed by people who at some point slip up and are apprehended. Not all of them, but I would say 80% of the episodes that I have seen thus far, crimes once unsolved when the show originally aired, have now been solved. And they put a chyron at the bottom of the screen and explain what in fact has happened.
But you do still get that. I just watched the Annie Laurie Heron one last night.
Yeah.
And you do like something about a chyron that's like such and so has never been found. It's just like, huh.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to stay unfound here in 2017. Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah. That just breaks your heart. Oh. There's a couple of those.
It really does. Her poor family.
Yeah, there's a couple of those in the first season. And Annie Laurie Heron's husband, who was a prosperous Jackson, Mississippi businessman, who ultimately her kidnapping and crimes associated with it was, I'm not spoiling anything here, the case is 30 years old, but was found to be the product of a disgruntled business associate of his. And, but yeah, she has never been found, and when you see and her husband died not knowing what in fact had happened to her, there's two or three examples of that in the first season that it's kind of hard to soldier on watching it once you've read that.
It is, but it does, it still holds up. I think you're so right that it has, it anticipated not only disappearing down a like wiki hole with various crimes, mm-hmm. but also the kind of poo-poo platter style in which we might sort of jump around in our TV viewing, sort of multitasking during it. And then the same way that back in the day when I was babysitting, the UFO segment was like, and time to go get more ice cream.
Exactly. Yeah.
Take my time, run some hot water on the scoop, because they were going to be rambling on about the Arizona desert for a while.
Wait to hear the theme song again.
And then Robert Stack had that perfect, like, he didn't take himself too seriously, but he brought great gravitas to a proceeding that was frequently, like, especially fashion-wise, ridiculous.
I thought Robert Stack was such a great choice, and you're right, like he clearly didn't take himself too seriously. He had been parodying his ultra serious self from The Untouchables all those years ago, at the very least since Airplane, which was 1980 and 7 years before Unsolved Mysteries. And this has and he as the host has a quality of lending a gravitas and credibility to what could otherwise be sort of tossed aside as, you know, cheap paperback grocery store aisle trash. And yet at the same time, not wanting you to spend a whole lot of time, you know, ruminating in terror over ghost stories and buried treasure. And there was a slight raise in the eyebrows that kept it from being serious to the point of being a dull.
Were you an In Search Of watcher with Leonard Nimoy?
No.
I think it was the exact same quality. Nimoy sometimes seemed a bit more credulous than Robert Stack, but he just had a like trustworthiness in his bearing and in having played Spock, the science officer, that kind of, it's like, okay, biorhythms, whatever. But he's like, you know, let's give it a chance and let this quote unquote doctor explain. And I think Stack had a very similar quality. And thank you for encouraging me to revisit this some more, because it really is always a pleasure. And if a segment is boring, you just skip it. It's kind of
great. Yeah, it does. It really did, without intending to, it really did sort of point the way towards how we watch television now. given that it was a smash hit in its time, but it was a smash hit with incredibly sort of, it was a smash hit without seeming to make the effort to be a smash hit. I still marvel at how influential
it is. Very diplomatically put.
Yeah. I mean, part of the reason it was on the air as long as it was incredibly cheap to produce. And I think that cheapness was not just, you know, a balance sheet decision. I think there was something about I think part of the reason that it ages perhaps better than the, you know, haircuts and fashion of it would or should is the sort of almost intentional lack of slickness in how it was filmed. There seems to be something almost sort of industrial film quality about it.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. It does. Speaking of film.
Yeah.
Where can we, you've been on tour tirelessly with Brat Pack America, a love letter to 80s teen movies. Mm-hmm. What is your next stop? Where can listeners find you?
I will be in Walnut Creek, California on Wednesday night at the at their public library. I will also be in Ann Arbor, Michigan on June 12th at Literati Bookstore downtown. And I'll be doing a bunch of stuff online and on social media throughout the summer.
And people can follow you on Twitter at Weegee. That's Weegee. Mm-hmm. You can follow this fine podcast on Twitter at Blotter Presents. Coming up, we've got Stephanie Green talking about Mommy, Dead, and Dearest from HBO. And my wife, Tara Ariano, will join us in 2 weeks for a discussion of Netflix's The Keepers. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Sarah. Really a pleasure being here with you.
I hope you'll be back and maybe discuss some Farinasodes of Unsolved Mysteries with us. In the meantime, this has been The Plotter Presents.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.